This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, November 25th, Uber's future in the City of London is looking bleak. We speak with Uber's UK chief, Jamie Haywood.
We will be challenging the decision, and during the period of this challenge, the app will remain on.
And the holiday shopping season is upon us. We hear from Imran Khan, the co-founder and CEO of e-commerce company Verishop.
I think the millennials are now willing to try a lot of new brands as opposed to their parent generation who are a fan of few brands.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Hong Kong voters have handed an overwhelming victory to pro-democracy candidates in local elections, and they did it in record numbers. To explain what this could mean for Hong Kong and for Beijing, Bloomberg's David Westin spoke with Max Baucus, a former U.S. ambassador to China and former chair of the Senate Finance Committee.
Give us a sense from your point of view of how important these elections were. I understand they were local district elections, but still, it's a pretty remarkable result.
Yes, it is. The protesters got a couple of victories. A passage of the Rubio bill, which revokes special status for Hong Kong if certain conditions are met. Second, the local elections. It is local. It's not LegCo. That's not the legislative body, which still is basically controlled by pro-Beijing members. But still, the local elections indicate that people are very upset with them. The management of Hong Kong by the Hong Kong government, pushed by Beijing. And so that's going to force Beijing and force the Hong Kong government to recalibrate.
Well, it's interesting. As I understand it, this is the one election they have that where there's universal suffrage. So it is an indication, I guess, of where the popular sentiment is, maybe the most accurate representation we've had. At the same time, could it relieve some of the pressure for Beijing? That is to say, if you're a protester, if you're part of the pro-democracy movement, you now have another way to make your views known.
You do. And regrettably, during the handover back in 97, Hong Kong was promised by China to move toward universal suffrage. They made that promise a couple, three times, and they kept being put off year after year, and China's not come through with it. So I don't think you'll see universal suffrage in the sense that we Americans understand it. But still, this is an indication that Beijing's going to have to slow down a little bit as they try to bring Hong Kong into the mainland China fold. And Carrie Lam, the chief executive, has got some problems on her hands. She basically wants to help the demonstrators, but she doesn't want to do it in a way that's going to upset Beijing. I was talking to her. I've been to Hong Kong several times the last couple of months in mainland China the last couple of months. And I was talking to Carrie Lam about 2 months ago, and she looked at me and she said, you know, it's tough serving two masters. She's got to serve Beijing, but she also wants to serve the people. But basically, it's Beijing that controls.
So let's talk about Beijing just for a moment. You were our U.S. ambassador, of course, to Beijing. Just today, we received word that our current U.S. ambassador has been summoned in by the Chinese government, I guess, to be read the riot act about what they claim is interference in Hong Kong. Did you ever get summoned in? What's the significance of that action?
Oh, yeah. Middle of the night, I got summoned in three times. It's important. The host country is expressing its views. It's very upset with what the United States has done. In this case, I'm sure it's the action passed by both the House and the Senate, potentially revoking special status for Hong Kong. Beijing doesn't like that one bit, and it has some effect, but basically it does not really determine what the next course is going to be.
So you said you met with Carrie Lam in the last couple of months when you were over there.
Yeah.
Did you get a sense from her about what she thought she could do to really bring this to a positive conclusion?
She's in a tough spot. I asked her if she's going to run for another term. She said, "Oh no. I'm not going to run for another term. I don't even want to continue this current term." She's a bureaucrat. She's very sympathetic with the people of Hong Kong. She grew up as a social service worker. She helped poor people in Hong Kong. She did a very good job with it. And I think that's partly why the Beijing government tapped her to be the chief executive. She cares. She cares a lot. But she's caught. She's caught between Beijing and its desire to do what's right for the people of Hong Kong.
Let me ask you at the same time about the trade negotiations going on, because we've just had word from China that they are going to be willing to really toughen up their intellectual property provisions, something you and I have talked about on more than one occasion. At the same time, we have some people say, you know what, whatever China agrees to, they often don't follow through in their trade agreement. Let's play something that Rick Scott, the senator from Florida, said to us recently.
President Xi committed to some terms of a contract agreement earlier this year and then changed his mind. So this is, it's consistent for Communist China. They talk a big game. They never comply.
Was that your experience with the Chinese government? Do they follow through on their trade agreements? I know that some people say they never really followed through with all the WTO commitments.
Well, the truth is somewhere in between. When I was over there, I learned pretty quickly something that's pretty corny. I came up with what I call my three P's. With the Chinese, you got to be patient, you got to be positive, and you got to be persistent. You stick with it, in a positive way, and after a while, you finally do get results. The big difference between the U.S. and China is clear. There's no independent judiciary in China. There's no way to enforce China to live up to their word.
That was Max Baucus, former U.S. ambassador to China and former chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Coming up, Jamie Haywood, Uber Regional General Manager for Northern and Eastern Europe. This is Bloomberg. From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. London hits the brakes, denying ride-hailing giant Uber a license in the UK city for the second time in less than 3 years. London's transport regulators cited safety concerns in the suspension, including the ability for unauthorized users to pose as drivers. For more on Uber, Romain Bostic and Guy Johnson spoke with Jamie Haywood, Uber Regional General Manager for Northern and Eastern Europe.
So today's decision by TfL not to renew Uber's license in London is both extraordinary and wrong. We will be challenging the decision, and during the period of this challenge, the app will remain on. Riders will be able to use the app to get around, and drivers will be able to use it to earn a living. I joined Uber 18 months ago from Amazon, and I've seen the company change, and I've seen how we've made our processes and systems more robust and how we've made safety our number one priority. TfL's wrong decision to renew our license does not reflect an Uber I recognize.
But basically, they have decided that you are going to lose your license. It has decided. TfL has decided. The mayor has decided. Let's sort of talk about how this is rectified. There is an error that has been highlighted by TfL in your verification software for your drivers. When did that first become apparent to you and the rest of the team at Uber? When was it fixed?
Yeah. So just to sort of elaborate a little bit, the issue that was identified was that there were 43 drivers who were able to swap photos with a friend, which meant that the photo that appeared on the app was not did not match the driver themselves. So this was something that we identified in May of this year, and as soon as we identified it, informed TfL proactively. What we also did is put in place technical fixes to make sure that it couldn't happen again and the vulnerability was closed. We stopped the drivers, the 43 drivers who've been implicated in this, from taking any new trips, and then we conducted a full audit of every single driver in London on the app to ensure that the technical fix had worked and the systems were strong.
So, Jamie, this is Romain in New York. So one of the issues that Uber, Lyft, and all of your competitors have dealt with is really kind of this broader issue of, I guess, operating either within the regulatory environment or on the outskirts of it, depending on what the business model currently is. Once you get outside of London and you go to other cities around the world, is this same issue going to crop up again?
So if we look at regulations, I mean, Uber is absolutely committed to making sure that we work within the regulatory environment of every single city we operate in globally. Just in the UK, we are licensed by over 70 licensing jurisdictions, each of which with their own rules, and each of which has their own way that they want to make sure that the private hire vehicle license operators are working for their city. So we're completely committed to making sure that we address those requirements. And what that does mean is that actually each of the configurations and each of the way we work with the cities in across the world is quite unique, and it's specific to the needs and requirements of those cities.
Is there not a way, Jamie? I understand that each city has their own unique regulations, and that's got to be a tough task to deal with. But is there not a discussion within the company to maybe set a high bar with regards to some of these regulatory issues that could be sort of, I guess, transferable across jurisdictions? That if the bar is high enough that you can meet London standards and New York standards and Mumbai standards and so on, then you won't have to run into these issues on a piecemeal basis.
So what Uber has in common with regulators around the world, everywhere, in all of the cities that you've listed, is that we both make safety the number one priority. That's something that Dara communicated very, very clearly when he came in 2 years ago. And when we look at rolling out tech developments and new products, such as just in UK last week, we launched discrimination button that allows riders or drivers who feel vulnerable on a trip to notify and speak to someone immediately, or our 24/7 emergency contact that again allows outreach from a rider or driver who wants to express a concern. These are all things we're doing to try and make riders and drivers and trips safer. That works with what regulators want. Regulators also want safer trips.
What is it that is going to convince the authorities to allow you to continue to operate on appeal? What are you going to say to the authorities to convince them that you are fit and proper to operate in London?
So we're going to lay out the facts as they are now about the strength of our systems, the way we authenticate drivers, the way we authenticate riders, the way we make sure that trips are safe. We believe on the strength of the facts, we will find our appeal upheld.
That was Jamie Haywood, Uber Regional General Manager for Northern and Eastern Europe. Coming up, Eric Skeens, co-founder and managing partner of 3Tree Tech. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take, context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on declining brokerage fees and how zero-cost investing caught on with Bloomberg's Annie Massa.
The situation.
Trading commissions have been coming down for a really long time, but what happened last month was Charles Schwab made this move to zero trading commissions for its customers, and all its other competitors had to follow suit.
The background.
The other front in the price war is on fund fees. So last year you saw Fidelity offer 4 index mutual funds for free, and that was a similar day where it really rocked the prices of different asset management stocks.
The argument.
Something that personal finance experts note, though, is the psychology of being able to trade for free might not benefit investors in the long run. That's just because over time, staying invested can be better, and actually trading more in and out of the market can hurt your portfolio over time.
For more on zero cost investing or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm June Grosso. Last week, AT&T announced it will begin 5G wireless service for consumers in more than 15 cities in the coming weeks. We should say this is a pilot. They're not expecting to make money, but it raises the question, what's the advantage for telecom companies to be early movers when it comes to the 5G wireless network? Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney spoke with Eric Skeens, co-founder and managing partner of 3Tree Tech.
The 5G market, when it comes to enterprises adopting the 5G technology and the solutions, right now there's a lot of different challenges that are coming about that. But AT&T and Verizon have started moving in that direction, and you'll see a significant move and shift for these large telecom carriers from the typical wireline technologies and solutions that have been dedicated lines to more in line with 5G and being able to go to market a lot faster. And so as enterprises are starting to adopt this, the big thing for these large organizations is the ability to shape and mold what direction this stuff is going into or the solutions are going into.
All I know about 5G is I can download movies faster. What's really the business case for the telecom industry investing capital in 5G, consumers investing their money and upgrading their phones to 5G? What's the real business case, do you think?
The 5G technology itself allows enterprises themselves. So in the past, when they were deploying locations, branches, they would leverage a technology called MPLS. And MPLS in the telecom world took 45 plus days in order to deploy. And 5G, when we're looking at 5G, you have a deployment time frame of 7 to 10 days where literally you're used to it with your cell phones or with your smartphones, is the ability to get your phone, you call in, you activate it. It's the exact same thing within business. The difference is 5G will allow for a significant amount of bandwidth to be able to, for those organizations to actually use it as a primary delivery point for data.
When we talk about 5G and the sort of revolutionary advancements that will come on the heels of it, I have to wonder why we're not seeing some of these companies lay out capital expenditure plans. In fact, it's the opposite. You're seeing AT&T cutting back, reducing leverage. You know, you're seeing layoffs in the industry. I'm struggling to pair the idea that there needs to be infrastructure spending with the reality of fiscal prudence.
Yeah. And that's a great point. So when you're looking at AT&T and Verizon, or even if you're looking at Comcast has been making a huge push within the mobility market. But within the Verizon and AT&T world, you're seeing them shed a bunch of infrastructure from a wireline perspective. So when you look at, it was a few years back, Verizon had moved a lot of their infrastructure off to Frontier. Because they knew it was a loss leader, they knew the margins were very thin, and started. You'll see that they're putting a massive push and spend into 5G deployments and building out of the towers and everything of that sort.
Let's talk about I want to talk about some of these other like non-telecom companies, like the tech companies, like Amazon, Microsoft, Google. You know, I seem to think that they are thinking about moving more and more into the telecom space. Are we seeing that? Is that a threat to some of the AT&Ts and Verizons of the world?
Yes, it definitely is a huge threat. Their ability, what they're doing is they're silently buying up a lot of infrastructure on the back end. And one of the things, you see it with Google Fiber at one point where they were trying to come out with all of their fiber infrastructure right out to the, and provide it for free and be a threat to the telecom. Yeah, the cable companies, yep, and everything of that sort. And Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, as they're continuing to build out the compute platform. The compute platform is huge within business, and what they're doing is building out their dark fiber,
yep,
as well as buying up undersea cables.
That was Eric Skeens, co-founder and managing partner of 3Tree Tech. And coming up, Imran Khan, the co-founder and CEO of e-commerce company Verishop. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. Fox Sports has sold out its inventory of Super Bowl ads after pricing 30-second spots for television's biggest annual event at a record $5.6 million. Fox finished selling all 77 national spots on Friday, according to Seth Winter, Executive Vice President for Sports Sales at Fox Sports. He said most ads for the NFL championship game tend to sell out around Christmas or even later into January. French ski resorts are being forced to spend millions reinforcing cable car supports and other structures being weakened by climate change that causes ice to melt. The Telegraph reports several resorts have spent millions shoring up cable car supports this year, and some resorts had to reinforce structures in danger of collapse because they are built on permafrost, layers of ground under the surface that remain permanently frozen, which are shrinking. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. It's 47 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg Opinion. David Weston spoke with columnist Frank Wilkinson about voting in Dane County, Wisconsin, and why it's important.
Bloomberg Opinion, informed perspectives, and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
From the Interactive Broker Studio, it's time now for Bloomberg Opinion, and we welcome today columnist Francis Wilkinson. So, Frank, thank you so much for joining us. You're writing about the election, and you're writing about it in a way I love, because it's not the flyover, what does the country think? It's sort of area by area, and specifically county by county. You talk about Dane County, Wisconsin. Why do you think that's informative?
Well, Dane is an odd place, and it may be a singular place. It's the county in Wisconsin that has Madison, which is, of course, a notoriously liberal city. But its demographics in terms of race are very similar to the state as a whole. It's about 80% non-Hispanic white, which is pretty much what the state of Wisconsin is. And, of course, in 2016, Wisconsin was won by Trump by about 22,000 to 23,000 votes, whereas Dane voted for Clinton by 3-1.
And so one of the things you focus us on the question of race and the fact that white voters turned out in large numbers in 2016, and President Trump got a majority of them. But as I read the piece, it's actually not entirely about race. It's also about density.
Well, it's about a number of things. You know, if you look at Dane, it has a couple of characteristics that stand out. One, education. University of Wisconsin at Madison is there, the dominant school in the state. It has about 50% of Dane County residents have a bachelor's degree, so it's a highly educated area. It also has high income. It's about $67,000 household median income. And it has a very liberal tradition that goes along with that. But yes, if you look at Democratic politics and Republican politics in the United States, what you find is that one party is associated with low-density areas, and that's, you know, the Republicans, with rural and small-town America, and one is highly associated with dense populations, cities in close suburbs, and that's the Democrats. And this plays out in Wisconsin as well. Milwaukee and Madison are highly Democratic. The rural parts of Wisconsin tend to be, like the rest of the United States, much more Republican.
Well, what does this tell us, if anything, about what's likely to happen next year? Because, as you suggested, President Trump won, albeit narrowly, in swing states like Wisconsin, like Michigan, like Pennsylvania. Has the nature of the voting group changed since then?
I don't think it has. What we've seen is enormous stasis with this presidency, where his approval rating really has been stuck in a very narrow range, no matter what he does. So I don't think it's going to be that kind of change. I think what we're going to see is whether the sort of demographics of Michigan and Pennsylvania, for instance, which are the other key states in that trio that you mentioned, which are more black, less white, and where black turnout was a fall off in 2016. If Democrats can improve their prospects among black voters in both of those states, and they're looking pretty good for Democrats at the moment, then it will come down to Wisconsin as a swing state if you hold all other things equal. And Wisconsin is a highly white state, so then you're talking about who turns out, which is why a place like Dane becomes more interesting to look at, just because it is kind of an outlier. Even with its education levels and its income levels, it's an oddly Democratic area for a place that is so white.
What does this tell us about the various Democrats who are running for president right now? And I'll give you a couple of examples. It's generally thought that former Vice President Joe Biden does relatively well with African Americans. It's generally thought that Pete Buttigieg, the mayor, has more trouble with African Americans. So does it indicate which candidates are likely to do better in those three critical swing states?
Well, I'm not really one who's willing to say what things are going to look like in a few months. It's November. We haven't had Iowa caucus yet. We haven't had New Hampshire primary, and we certainly have not had the South Carolina race. So which is one which will be dominated by black voters in the Democratic primary. You know, right now, you're absolutely correct that Biden is very strong with black voters. Buttigieg is very weak, as are most of the other candidates, for that matter.
That was Bloomberg Opinion columnist Frank Wilkinson. You can read more on this and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion and on the terminal by typing OPIN Go. Holiday shopping is right around the corner, and Bloomberg's Romain Bostic spoke with Imran Khan, the co-founder and CEO of e-commerce company Verishop and former Snap chief strategy officer.
All right, Imran, this is a relatively new website,
yes,
a relatively new platform, in a sea of several other platforms. I guess my first question is why? What's the strategy here?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, e-commerce is only 10% of overall retail sales. And whenever a market gets 10% penetration, we usually see accelerated disruption. We saw that with Netflix. When Netflix got 10% penetration, Blockbuster went out of business. We saw that with digital advertising. When digital advertising reached 10%, we saw accelerated growth. So I think e-commerce will be 30 to 40% of the market, mm-hmm. and not one company can solve all problems, and there will be new players. The second big thing is I think the consumer's loyalty to brands have been decreasing.
Yeah.
You know, I think the millennials are now willing to try a lot of new brands as opposed to their parent generation who are a fan of few brands. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot of new brands popping up, and there's not a lot of good places to discover those brands. So we created this platform to consumers to discover a lot of cool new brands.
Sure.
And then the third thing is that we're also seeing that a lot of the large brands who are heavily dependent on department stores, they need a new avenue of distribution, and we are becoming a distribution platform for them as well.
And one thing that gets consumers' attention is a free one-day shipping as well. Is that going to be a permanent feature? Because we know from seeing other companies that this can get awfully expensive awfully quickly. Amazon, for instance, sees its costs expanding and rising on this.
Yeah, we believe that consumer shops for four reasons: price, quality, convenience, and selection. And one of the things that we promised, a brand is a promise, and Verishop promise is that convenience is one of the areas that we're going to focus on. So we're going to continue to invest more and more. How can we deliver the product faster, better, and more efficiently? And then the second promise is discovery. So we're bringing in all these global international brands, a lot of these new discovery brands that you would not find anywhere else.
But what's the advantage here? I mean, you're bringing in all of these brands, but then I'm sure there are some department store executives over at Macy's or Bloomingdale's that would say, well, we already do that. What's the attraction for me to go to Verishop instead of going to Macy's.com or to Walmart.com?
Yeah, and I think I'm going to go back to the Verishop promise.
And this is just about a broadening market?
Or? Yeah, no. I think I'm going to go back to Verishop promise.
Right.
Number one is in terms of discovery, mm-hmm. if you look at our top 10 brands in men, women, home, and beauty, mm-hmm. many of those brands, probably more than half of them, you will not find it any other department stores or other stores. So they're really discovery brands.
Okay.
You know, I think one of the things that's happening in the retail industry, I call it democratization of retail. So democratization of retail is a 2.0 of democratization of media. So think about it. Before 2000, if you wanted to be a creator, mm-hmm. Your life was controlled by few media outlets.
Yeah.
But then bloggers came along, then YouTubers came along, then Instagrammers and Snapchatters came along, and content really fragmented and people consuming content from many different places.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing is happening in retail. People don't want to wear the same thing. They're trying lots of different things. So you need a place to discover that.
Will you have a physical component to this? Will there be a brick-and-mortar showroom, for instance? Because as much as I love the idea of discovering new brands and experimenting and seeing your curated selection, if I can't see it or feel it, I'm not assured of the quality.
So that goes back to our second promise, which is convenience. So we have free one-day shipping and free return and 24/7 customers. So
but
you can actually
feel it before I actually buy it.
Yeah, but you can return it, right? So the key thing is in the physical stores, it's really difficult to house all sorts of choices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that we're never going to have physical stores, but the thing is that when you the benefit of the digital world is that you can have unlimited selections. And so that really, and through machine learning, ultimately you can match the people, right content with the right person.
All good points, but every single digital brand has ended up creating a digital, an actual physical store as well.
I mean, do people know Verishop? I mean, I know it's you only started the site earlier this year, but is it at a stage now where you have enough brand awareness?
No, not where we need to be, but right. I think our brand awareness is growing really nicely. Right. Like, I think December, I'm expecting that we'll have roughly 1 million monthly unique users on our site, so which is pretty healthy growth for a company.
About brick and mortar. There's a lot of empty spots down Fifth Avenue here.
That was Imran Khan, the co-founder and CEO of e-commerce company VeriShop. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. You can see all of our best work at NIBest Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our show is produced by Caroline O'Brien. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.